Oh, Friday. Time for something brand new and different. 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD. The show's the same. It's how music changed, as always, as it has been for decades. And I'm Tom Ryan. That's the same with my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan. That hasn't changed.
Running the board.
That's right.
But never bored.
I hope not. I hope not today. But because today we're going to start a completely different series from where we have been. And by completely different, I mean we're now getting back up to something which is a bit more contemporary than where we had been with the anthology of folk music. Now we are going to be covering the music of Pink Floyd. And this is going to be a strange and sometimes difficult one for me because we did cover a lot of their albums and I don't want to be too redundant when we do this entire series. So I'll be going probably a little bit deeper on the albums that we did not cover on Wednesday. And I'm going to have to figure out some way to figure out how I want to cover the music from the albums that we already did cover on Wednesday so that it's not too redundant or repetitive. We'll do that as we can. But right now we're at the very beginning, which means there's going to be more talk than music because there's a lot of history to get us started. And all I can just say is, like, considering how the band eventually, where they eventually ended up, the beginning is just, you know, such innocence. Soon, the band would be altering the world of music by way of altering minds, but they certainly did start out innocently enough. Our first show covering the history of Pink Floyd focuses on their early lives, most of it before they became recording stars and psychedelic heroes of the London Underground. At first, Pink Floyd were a somewhat mediocre British blues band, and before that, they were not even sure that they were going to be that. And that's what we're going to be covering today, is that era. Like just about every other band in the UK at that point in time, though, everybody started out more or less playing the blues, American blues. Eventually, though, Pink Floyd started to diverge when they discovered how they could combine their live performance with psychedelic influences. So most beginnings are fairly modest. But hold on, world. Things are going to change quickly as we move through this series. So our story with Pink Floyd starts in Cambridge. Now, what we're going to do, since there's going to be so much talking before we even get to music, is I want to play some bed music. And there were a couple of lengthy tracks that were released before Pink Floyd even put out a single for a movie that was called Tonight Let's Make Love in London. I will admit that they're almost appallingly bad, but they did record them and they were done for the movie. And one of them is not known at all, I don't think. And another one is a not familiar version of a song that is known by Pink Floyd fans. The first unknown song is called Nick's Boogie, as we'll start. And then we can maybe let that flow into a version of Interstellar Overdrive, which is not the version that appears on their debut album. But we'll do that later. We'll start, though, with Nick's Boogie as bed music. Can we let that roll? Why not? Good. Excellent. Okay, so we start in Cambridge. According to David Gilmour, you're in a town dominated by education. You're surrounded by bright people. But then it's also got this rural heart that spreads practically to the center. There are great places to meet up with friends. This intellectually stimulating place with its pastoral setting was to leave its mark on the early years of the Floyd. Now, we'll start by talking about the soul of the group, the person most responsible for what Pink Floyd originally became. Roger Keith Barrett, nicknamed Sid, born in Cambridge on January 6th, 1946. He was the fourth child of five children. His father was a music lover, a very good classical pianist, and a musician. So it was only natural that he tried to get his children to do the same. And all of them, in some shape or form, played an instrument. After a few years, Sid himself entered the prestigious Cambridgeshire High School for Boys, but he had little interest in any of the subjects, except for art, because he loved art, and he always played. He couldn't care less about the discipline and stuff. All that he really wanted to do was art and music. Unfortunately, though, on December 11, 1961, his father died just a few weeks after being diagnosed with inoperable cancer. This was a disaster. Sid was profoundly affected by the loss of his dad. The family's worsening financial circumstances forced his mother to take in lodgers, which radically changed the atmosphere that had reigned in the family home up until then. Sid took refuge more than ever in painting and music, started listening to rock and roll music and records, started by playing the ukulele and the banjo, but eventually he took up guitar. He joined his first group in around 1962. He called it the Mottos, M-O-T-T-O-E-S. And occasionally he would play acoustic guitar and he would meet up with a friend. According to Roger Waters, he actually had a guitar that was imported by Selmer and manufactured in Czechoslovakia. It was the same model that George Harrison had been using in Hamburg, coincidentally. But they would just basically play hits by the Shadows, Eddie Cochran and Buddy Holly, like any, you know, teenagers would do. And the rehearsal was at Barrett's home, where they also took in lodgers, as I had mentioned. Roger's old playroom now had the atmosphere of a coffee bar as the teenagers chatted, smoked, and listened to records, proudly showing off their new guitars. Now, he calls him Roger, but the original name, Sid, is the subject of debate. According to Nick Mason, Sid wasn't always Sid. He had been Roger Keith, but he met there was a drummer there whose name was Sid Barrett, and the club regulars immediately nicknamed this new guy, whose last name was Barrett, Sid, but with a Y to avoid confusion. Others say that they simply found that the first name of this drummer was to Sid's liking, so he decided to call himself Sid as well. Regardless. Another member of the band, David Gilmour, was a close friend of Sid's. He was born in Truppington, a village near Cambridge. And he was not far from, like, near Sid was living, and he was the eldest of four children. His mother was a teacher and a film editor, and his father was a senior lecturer in zoology at Cambridge University. Like Sid, David Gilmour came from a family of intellectuals, interested in different forms of artistic expression. My parents sung well, he said. My brother played flute, my sister the violin. David wanted to play guitar, and he was interested in Bill Haley and Elvis Presley, Howlin' Wolf and blues like Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. But he was also interested in the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. David Gilmour would not, though, become an original member of Pink Floyd. Another good friend, though, would. Musical tastes very similar to Sid and David was George Roger Waters, born in Great Bookham, Surrey, on September 6, 1943. He was known as Roger, of course, the youngest son of Mary and Eric Fletcher Waters. His father was a phys ed teacher, a devout Christian, and a member of the Communist Party. This is interesting on the future of Roger Waters, I think. His father was a conscientious objector when Great Britain declared war against Nazi Germany. He also served as an ambulance driver during the Blitz. He did subsequently enlist in the British Army, and he was, following the Allied landing at Anzio, he was killed. As a result, Roger Waters, then aged 5 months, would never get to even know his father. As you might, if you're a Pink Floyd fan, you'll probably know that by some of their material. His mother was a teacher by profession, and a few years later, Rogers entered the Cambridge Shire High School for Boys, where Syd Barrett was also studying. And they eventually bonded and started, by the age of 15, they were starting to play together. Eventually, though, as it says, all roads lead to London. And in September, Syd Barrett embarked on an art course at the Cambridge College of Arts and Technology, where David Gilmour was studying modern languages. Roger Waters left Cambridge to study art at the Regent Polytechnic in London. All three of them had notched up a variety of musical experiences. Roger Waters, in autumn of 1963, became a member of a group with two of his fellow students, Clive Metcalf and Keith Noble. He goes, I suppose we formed several groups there. He goes, I wasn't serious. We just sat around talking about how we would spend the money we would make. Eventually, though, the other two members that eventually became part of the band came into play. Richard William Wright, born July 28th in 1943. His father was a biochemist, a well-heeled suburb in northwest London called Hatch End. He was the beneficiary of a middle-class education, attending a very select private school. He initially learned piano and trumpet, and later, while convalescing from a broken leg, taught himself the guitar by listening to American pioneers of the blues. Nick Mason would remember him as being quiet and introverted. Speaking of Nick Mason, he was also smitten with rock and roll, and he dreamed of starting a band with his pals, even though he couldn't play an instrument and none of his friends could either. It was more or less by default that Nick started to play percussion, because somebody had given him a pair of brushes as a present. He said, after the failure of my earlier piano and violin lessons, this seemed a perfectly legitimate reason to become a drummer. So Waters, Mason, and Wright, the latter having quit the Regent Street Polytechnic for the London College of Music, decided to pursue their musical adventure together, leaving their other friends, Metcalf and Noble, to go their own way. 39 Stanhope Gardens in the London district of Highgate was this huge Edwardian house that had just been bought by somebody named Mike Leonard, a devotee of light shows, who was also a lecturer at Regent Street Polytechnic. It became not only their home, but also a new rehearsal space. Stanhope Gardens made a real difference to our musical activities, said Nick Mason. We had our own permanent rehearsal facility, thanks to an indulgent landlord. Rehearsals took place in the front room of the flat, where all of the equipment was permanently set up. Unfortunately, this made any study very difficult and sleep almost out of the question, since it was also Roger's and my bedroom. They formed a band with a few of the members, but Rogers thought about bringing Syd into the band as soon as he heard that his childhood friend had come to college in London. It was great when Syd joined, recalls Rick Wright. Before him, we'd play R&B classics because that's what all groups were supposed to be doing then. But I never liked R&B that very much. I was actually more of a jazz fan. With Syd, the direction changed. It became more improvised around the guitar and keyboards. Roger started to play the bass as a lead instrument, and I started to introduce more of my classical feel. However, it seems that before the future Pink Floyd, Syd had doubts about how he would fit in. Bob Close, one of the members of the band at that point in time, recalls in his first appearance, in the middle of the rehearsal session that would seal Chris's fate, Syd, arriving late, watched quietly from the top of the stairs. Afterwards, he said, "Yeah, it sounded great, but I don't see what I would do in the band." 2 months later, though, Syd did join in December of 1964. The group recorded a demo of their first few songs in a small Decca-owned studio in Broadhurst Gardens, West Hampstead. Now, while we're hearing the song called Nick's Boogie, the bed music, I think it could move on, or we can play the demo track that they played at this point in time. This is what they were sounding like when they went to the studio in Broadhurst Gardens. They, doing what pretty much everybody did, they decided to do a version of a Slim Harpo song called I'm a King Bee. So we can pull back from Nick's Boogie and start with one of the very first recordings that the band made as the members of Pink Floyd, called I'm a King Bee.
Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. Yes, I'm a king bee, child, buzzing around your hive. I can make good honey, let me. You know I'm young and able to buzz all night long. Well, when you hear me buzz, little girl, know some stinging going on. Well, buzz some. Oh, sting.
Never guessed that that would have been Pink Floyd. But technically, they were not yet Pink Floyd at that point in time. They were calling themselves the Tea Set, as in have a cup of tea. And that's their version of a Slim Harpo tune called I'm a King Bee, one of the first things that they recorded, sort of sounding like a stoned version of the Rolling Stones on that track, if you ask me. But Sid very quickly took to writing, because he was by far the most creative member, the most inspired to do that sort of a thing. And at some point in time, they decided, Sid, you know, like I said, Sid joined, and they would change their name very quickly to Pink Floyd, naming themselves after a combination of two blues artists with the names joined together. Because they were still more or less emulating the blues, but no longer wanting to cover it, so to speak, with Sid writing his own style of songs. So let's play one of the really early songs that Sid had written around this time, just to basically give a taste of how quickly the flavor of what the group was about changed. This is a Syd Barrett composition. It's called Lucy Leave. Composition called Lucy Leave. Now, around this time, there was a man, a friend named Bob Close, who was still in the group, but he left them. He left the group in the summer of 1965 to concentrate on his studies. And interestingly, at around that same time, Syd Barrett and I guess you could call him his best friend, David Gilmour, set off for the south of France. Now, this is interesting and in a way, funny to think that Syd, I don't think most people recognize this, because David Gilmour is the person who would eventually replace Syd in Pink Floyd. But in the very beginning, David Gilmour was not in the band. Syd was, and it wasn't until Syd ended up having to leave because of his mental issues that David Gilmour came in to take his place. But before any of that was going down, they were very, very good friends. So it was also on this time that the T-Set was renamed the Pink Floyd after, like I said, after American, some blues artists. And then the group was offered gigs around clubs and universities and played as often as they could. Now, while their various engagements at the, you know, London clubs enabled Pink Floyd Sound, as they called themselves at first, the Pink Floyd Sound, to make a name for themselves, it was without doubt their participation in what was called the Giant Mystery happening at the Marquee Club that was to seal the band's future. These happenings, also known as the Spontaneous Underground, were aimed at celebrating an alternative culture in a creative ferment, and it was the brainchild of an American named Steve Stolman, who had come to London to search for new talent with which to help his brother Bernard's record label, ESP Disc. He figured that he could find people and then bring them to America, perhaps, to record. So Stolman booked the Marquee Club, which was the mecca of the English rock scene in the early 60s, or I should say in the early 66, nice 65, 66, for the first of the giant mystery happenings, which actually had famous people such as Donovan, Graham Bond, and Mose Allison. They all appeared. And then he repeated the experiment later in February, and then again on March 13th on every Sunday afternoon, at least once a month, and then continually on Sundays. It was as the Pink Floyd sound that Syd Barrett, Roger Waters, Rick Wright, and Nick Mason rose to the challenge and participated in the third event, billed on the flyers as, quote, the trip. Steve Stolman said, quote, I hadn't a clue who they were, but somebody suggested them. Let's hear one more very early track by Syd about what he was like before it got too psychedelic. We can play the song Remember Me.
Remember me! I've been here before. Remember me! I've been here before. Can't you see? I'm gonna stick around some more. Can't you see? I want some love from you. Can't you see? I want some love from you. Don't go away now. I got something to give to you.
Ready here, it's hard to even know who's singing that. If that's Syd, it's really hard to believe, right? I can't tell you whose voice that is.
Yeah, it didn't sound like Syd, but I don't know.
Yeah, but it's definitely Pink Floyd, and that's Syd who wrote it. And if that's him the way he's singing then, it changes distinctly with time.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a quote by a guy named Nigel Lamour Gordon. He says, I knew Steve Stolman. He was the guy that was setting up the trip that I was just talking about before we played that song. He was looking for experimental music, and nobody else wanted to play those Sunday afternoon sessions. Because that's how they got the Floyd. They were the only ones willing to play on a Sunday afternoon. Floyd's lengthy blues-derived psychedelic improvisations actually caused quite a sensation among the hip young Londoners lucky enough to find themselves at the appropriately named trip. Oh, by the way, you're listening to 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD, Garden City, New York. So, this character named Hoppy, his real name John Hopkins, was a leading photographer of the swinging London scene and a key figure in the British counterculture. And he remembers the first time that he saw Pink Floyd. He goes, "It was like walking into a wall of sound, not unmusical, but certainly something like I'd never heard before. Barrett, Waters, Wright, and Mason all took part in Stallman's marquee events again from late March until mid-June, and then again from September to the end of 1966, although the exact dates are not known or remembered by anybody." Let's play one more song. This one is a song that was actually written by the group as a whole. All four of them together took writing credits for this thing, maybe setting up an idea for where how the changes were beginning to take place. This is called Double Oboe.
Bo Diddley was a private eye. Hand was fast and his IQ high. Dear said Double O, you won't last. Slow down, boy, you living too fast. Well, Double O had a Cadillac, machine guns and a bulletproof back, engine taken from a 707. Sounds like a sure way getting to heaven.
Double O Bow, a bit of a, I guess, obviously, Double O Bow Diddley Bow, sort of a bow thing happening there. Okay, so where was I? The band, let's see. We said that Pink Floyd's improvisations caused a sensation among the Londoners lucky enough to find themselves there and that how often they had played. But it was at the Spontaneous Underground in 1966 that Peter Jenner first heard the hallucinogenic music that was happening by Barrett, Waters, Wright, and Mason. The Floyd were doing mostly blues songs, But instead of having howling guitar solos with the guitarist leaning back like all guitarists did back then, they were doing cosmic stuff. They were doing interesting blues songs, but it wasn't what they did that made them interesting. It was Sid's way of being distinctive and filling in the gaps instead of like a howling guitar solo. So instinctively, Jenner set his sights on Pink Floyd, although at first he could not work out where their strange sonority came from. "It turned out to be Sid and Rick," he recalls. "Sid had his Benson Echoric, and he was doing weird things with feedback. Rick was also producing some strange, long, shifting chords. Nick was using mallets. That was the thing that got me. This was avant-garde. Sold!" Pink Floyd was innovative, while at the same time preserving the original spirit of rock and roll. Their experimentation and Syd Barrett's intriguing and seductive dandy image struck Jenner and King as providing all the necessary ingredients for success. In September of 1966, Peter Jenner and Andrew King became their official managers. "Peter focused on us. Of the two, Peter was the hustler and the diplomat who could talk his way into a deal. Peter described himself as an A1 BSer, still am, and had the added bonus of a link into the underground scene. Andrew was more relaxed and a lot of fun to be around, but his taste for a good time sometimes led to moments of unreliability." But on October 31st, Barrett, Waters, Wright, and Mason became the partners with Jenner and King in Black Hill Enterprises. In keeping with the hippie philosophy of the day, any profits accumulated by the group, along with any from any ventures with other artists already signed or about to be signed to the company, were to be distributed six ways. Those other artists, by the way, included Mark Bolan, the future leader of T-Rex, Roy Harper, and Kevin Ayers. They were very nice, an honorable exception to the shady rule about managers, and really cared for the people they worked for, noted Robert Wyatt, then the drummer and singer for Soft Machine. Jenner and King, who had an extensive network of friends and acquaintances, introduced Pink Floyd to the London Underground movement, opening wide doors of the London Free School and those of the swinging London, other doors of the swinging London, to them. The group played at the All Saints Church Hall, which became famous for its light shows, appearing alongside Soft Machine. And there was also a counterculture by a magazine who was by Hoppy, who we had mentioned earlier, and finally the famous UFO Club. Now, it was around January of 1967 that Pink Floyd recorded that song Nick's Boogie, which we opened up as the bed music, for the soundtrack of a documentary called Tonight Let's All Make Love in London. Now, at this point in time, Joe Boyd was at the board of Sound Techniques Studios. He was an American producer, and he was considered as signing Pink Floyd to Elektra. Unfortunately, his boss, Jack Holtzman, who had only heard the group rehearsing on stage, was totally against it. Polydor, on the other hand, the label to which at the time The Who and Cream were signed, showed genuine interest and offered them an advance. But too late, because Brian Morrison, who was originally signed to line up gigs for the group, had entered into what proved to be negotiations with EMI. But before we get there, let's play some more of these really early tracks that we've got before we get too far into ahead of ourselves. This is a song, the very first song that is known to have been written by Roger Waters himself. It's called Walk With Me, Sydney.
Baggy knees and a broken frame, meningitis, peritonitis, DTs, and a washed out brain. Baggy knees and a broken frame, meningitis, peritonitis, DTs and a washed out brain.
Sure did have a lot of maladies.
A lot going wrong at that point in time.
But that sounds like a ripoff of Talk to Me, Henry.
Oh.
Remember that song?
Yeah. That same thing as like...
girls sing.
Dance With Me. Yeah. Dance With Me, Henry, and talk to all that.
Something like that.
Huh. Well, at this point in time, Roger Waters is not the songwriter that he would eventually become. That's an understatement.
He's just warming up.
Yeah, and you can also tell that he is pretty much, well, not at this point, because you can't even say that Sid is actually showing anything of remarkable renown at this point. But they did play for the UFO Club, which was a club, I believe, that was being run by Joe Boyd and Hoppy together. John Hopkins. They started a club called the UFO. Pink Floyd would become regulars there at the scene, plus also places like the Roundhouse. That's where they also played with Soft Machine. But by the end of 1966, the Pink Floyd sound had already distanced themselves from the popular music of the United States and started to make a mark for themselves as one of the major groups on London's new music scene. Andrew King would later reveal, "We didn't realize it, but the tide was coming up the beach and the Pink Floyd were right on top of the wave." Now, the story is a bit ahead of the music that I'm playing because these songs are still a little bit further before the live performance. So let's play one more track from here. It's a song, another Sid song. It's called Butterfly. That was written by Sid. We'll cover that, and then we'll probably be able to go out with one of the crazy psychedelic live recording. Well, not live recordings, but the early recording, pre-album and even their first single. But let's hear one more Sid tune. This is called Butterfly, one of the best of the early tracks, in my opinion.
Thank you. you gonna catch you soon in my butterfly net. You better watch out. Sometime when I watch you, I stretch out my hand to touch you, cause it drives me wild to see you flutter by, you butterfly. I won't squeeze you dead, feeling through your head. I just want your love.
That sounds like Sid. It's the first song.
He's starting to become a fully realized Sid Barrett.
Yes, that is definitely a taste of things to come right there. So this brings us to, let's see, it was around on January 11th and 12th of 1967, Pink Floyd recorded Nick's Boogie, which was the bed music that we opened with, and a version of Interstellar Overdrive for the soundtrack of Peter Whitehead's documentary, Tonight, Let's All Make Love in London. Now, Joe Boyd was the producer of these songs. He was the natural choice to record Interstellar Overdrive, the song that Floyd had chosen for the soundtrack at Sound Technique Studios in Chelsea on January 11th and 12th of 1967. And Boyd tried very hard to get the group signed by Elektra, but it was refused by Jack Holtzman, the man who ran the label. They then turned to Polydor, and at that point, Boyd was going to act as their producer on an independent basis. We'll pick up that story next week about how they pretty much ended up totally screwing Joe Boyd out of what was his due for producing not just the track for the movie, but their first single, which is perhaps some of the best music that they've ever recorded. We'll leave you, though, with this not particularly well-known version of Interstellar Overdrive. See you next week with the first singles and their first album. Take care, folks.